The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hello and welcome to Harry and I's discussion of the recently released film Nosferatu. This was directed by Robert Eggers, who is one of our favourite directors, I think it's safe to say.
Certainly my favourite director of the moment.
I would say the same thing, because I think Stanley Kubrick, you know, always be number one for me.
Yeah, and David Lynch is my favourite overall, but he's not really releasing anything these days. There's always rumours spreading that he's about to do something with Netflix, or maybe he's going to carry on Twin Peaks in some esoteric and roundabout way. But the man's nearing his 80s now, and he's living in LA, which is just burned down. So, you know, best wishes to him.
Stay safe.
I don't think anything's going to be coming from him anytime soon. I'd love to be proven wrong, though.
Yes. So Nosferatu, obviously, is something that is not unfamiliar to most people. Most people are familiar with the name, which is a made-up name, of course. And this, of course, is a thing that was inspired by Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Heavily inspired.
Some might say his widow. Copying.
Yeah, his widow might even argue, which she did, that it was a complete rip-off.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the original film was ordered by the courts to be destroyed because it was so similar to the original. And this was released in, what, 1922, wasn't it?
Yeah, the original was 1922. It was some production company in Germany that only released one film, which was Nosferatu. And the reason that they ordered it to be destroyed was by the time that they were making the court order against them, they had no money. They were bankrupt, so they couldn't defend themselves in court.
I understand of it, obviously it was a long time ago and it also doesn't matter, but I'm going to be pedantic anyway, is that the occultists set up the film company, because it was funded by an occultist figure, to make films about the occult, and this was going to be the first one. And basically, to avoid having to pay a large sum of money, he made the film company bankrupt as a choice.
Oh, okay.
To avoid the potential hefty fines.
That makes sense. Pretty scummy behavior overall.
Well, I don't agree with the notion of intellectual property. So I don't think it's like how the Verve's Bittersweet Symphony pays the Rolling Stones, even though what they did with the samples is entirely different.
Wait, I didn't even realize that song sampled the Rolling Stones. I've not listened to it in a while.
A string part in one of the Rolling Stones' more esoteric
albums. Oh, is that what the main string refrain of the song is?
But they've added stuff, they've moved it around, they've changed the character of it.
It's turned entirely it into a different. Completely different song.
Mm-hmm. And just as Dracula is one story, I think Nosferatu is another. And although they're similar and they're playing off of vampire sort of myths,
folklore,
that's a better word for it. It's the same with anything, really, isn't it? It's like folk music, in that things pass around through word of mouth, and it sort of gets embellished slightly over time. That's natural. Well, and I think it's healthy.
Oral tradition, which is passed down through generations of a particular culture. So I agree with you that it's healthy. Just to harp on the intellectual property thing as well, we have both complained at length about people accusing Led Zeppelin of ripping off various blues artists and blues songs. I have complained about this online, and somebody sent me a song that was supposedly the song that Led Zeppelin ripped off for Whole Lotta Love, which has one verse that has the same lyrics, otherwise is a completely different song, and they sound nothing like one another. Too often, sadly, the argument of intellectual property can be used so that somebody who is unsuccessful, unknown, basically a nobody, can piggyback off of the success of somebody else.
Notice how it was Bram Stoker's widow that did it. You know, payday. Also for the Rolling Stones and the Verve, it was their lawyers, and the Rolling Stones said, oh, the Verve song's way better than ours, they should keep the money, and that's not happened. It's,
you know,
just that the lawyers
respect to them,
the
I suppose.
Yeah. Actual creatives can respect other people's creativity and they can see that it's distinct, but when there's money involved, people tend to be scummy.
Yeah, thank God that there weren't lawyers about when we first figured out the diatonic scales, or they'd all be copyrighted. And then you wouldn't be able to do anything.
Well, I mean, pharmaceutical companies can copyright chemical compounds. Like, the actual aspects of the way our universe works can be copyrighted.
That's very interesting. I think we're going a little bit off topic here, which I have helped along. So
I'm just hammering that point home. But the point being is that there are lots and lots of adaptations of Nosferatu. I think around 30 in total, if not more so. Certainly even more if you include amateur productions and perhaps stage plays and things like that.
Well, I think Robert Eggers has said that in his childhood, he put on a school performance of Nosferatu.
That was his foray into sort of the performing arts, in a sense, isn't it? Yeah. He started off as a bit of an actor rather than a director, and it was I think he had a role in directing that play, but it was very different.
Yeah, well, this has been a passion project of his. And on the subject of the other versions of Nosferatu, in preparation for this, I decided to watch the two most famous ones, which is the original 1922 film, and then Werner Herzog's 1979 adaptation, which is a strange hybrid because it's telling the story of Nosferatu, the 1922 film, but changes everybody's name so that they're back to the original Bram Stoker name. So it's not Nosferatu, it's Count Dracula. You're not following Thomas Hutter, you're following Jonathan Harker. So it's a strange mix of the two, but overall follows the same beats, with a few additions that Herzog put in himself. And it was the first Herzog film that I've ever watched. I really enjoyed it. I've got to admit, I much preferred it to the original one, because the original one, I understand, is a German expressionist classic. It set the stage for a lot of different film techniques, special effects. The use of shadow especially is wonderful. But perhaps I'm just spoiled by the delights of color and sound that we get these days with films. The actual style of silent film does not work as well for me.
I was thinking about this in terms of aviation, because I agree that the 22 film is very important and it's very useful for film analysis, perhaps. However, as an actual thing to watch, I think more recent forays are better. And it's similar in my mind to, you know, an old biplane compared to, say, maybe not a Boeing 747. Those are a bit dodgy. Like, I don't know, a modern plane, you know. The old biplane has a certain charm to it. It's, you know, a bit fanciful and a little bit outdated, but also it's got a lot of character to it. However, if you were to actually use the product to sound sort of disgustingly consumerist, you would rather use the modern one because the technology has moved so far.
Objectively, it's just better, right? Mm-hmm. But we do have to, you know, thank the original for being made in the first place, because otherwise we wouldn't be getting wonderful adaptations of the story like Robert Eggers' version.
Yeah, and it also doesn't mean that we can't acknowledge the fact that it was very important at the time of its release and it was very influential. However, sometimes these things don't necessarily translate well, at least in my opinion.
I think it also didn't help that because it's public domain and there are so many different versions of the film, the version that I watched half of, that I watched first, was a public domain one on YouTube, which had remastered the picture, so it was all nice crisp HD, and changed a lot of the cards, and also used very different music. And the picture as well was in black and white, where the original one is tinted, depending on what time of the day it's supposed to be. So the nighttime scenes were all shot during the day, but on the original version, they're tinted blue so that you know that it's taking place at nighttime. This was all picture-perfect, crisp, black and white. So it just looks like Nosferatu himself is just roaming about in the middle of the day, which confused me somewhat. And then it did. The worst part was the music that they chose. It's a horror film. It's a gothic horror film. Some might argue the original gothic horror film. It's supposed to have scary music with organ stings to let you know when you're supposed to jump. This had the most pleasant classical music playing in the background. Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite to the level of do 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 do, but it was close. And I almost fell asleep 10 times watching it. So I was like, what on earth is all the big fuss about with this?
And then nice Dracula film to fall asleep to.
I know. And then I found a better version of it, which was more along the lines of the original, with better title, with better cards used, the tinting kept there, lower picture quality, but that actually helped. And the entire thing was soundtracked by spooky organ.
So there's two things to say here. First of all, the director, Robert Eggers, actually told a story about how he saw a still from the original Nosferatu and he thought it was the coolest thing he'd ever seen. And he said to his mum, I want to watch this film. And so they ordered it in the video store and it took a month to arrive. And apparently, because it was quite old as well, it was quite grainy and worn out. And he said that actually added to the film because he had seen more modern recreations, I suppose, or remasters, whatever you want to call it. And the precision of the image didn't help it. Actually, the sort of fading and degradation of it helped sell the original films.
I think it becomes more immersive with something like that. It feels more like you're watching something that's real rather than a piece of fiction.
I'd like to think of it as sort of him almost thinking it's like found footage.
Yeah.
As a young kid. But one important thing about that you're talking about the original is that they used sort of slides to color the thing. That's exactly how Eggers gets the amazing nighttime scenes. Some of the best visuals of nighttime and darkness I think I've ever seen in a film, by the way. Which is saying something because, of course, so many films do it. Normally, in a lot of modern cinema, when it's very dark and there's a sort of love of the dark over the past 5 to 10 years in both TV and cinema, I'm thinking Game of Thrones was very guilty of it.
Oh, don't remind me of Game of Thrones.
I know, but you tend not to be able to make out anything. But what Eggers did was had it very bright, but then put a... they basically eliminated the reds at the camera level and had a blue filter over it. So it was mostly blue and green light, but mostly blue. There would still be a little bit of green there. But that gives you an impression of things being illuminated by moonlight. And that
it
really works
very well. And
I was so surprised at how well done it was. And it really goes well to sell the film as a really polished piece of cinema, I suppose.
Oh yeah, I mean, this is one of the best looking films I've ever watched.
I agree.
Honestly, every frame is gorgeous in this film, and it's very, very impressive because Eggers is already a very technically accomplished filmmaker.
Well, let's talk about his previous films, actually.
Well,
that's important.
Just let me. Okay. This film was on what is today considered a mid-level budget, which was about $50 million, and I believe globally it's already taken in more than $100 million. So, if you were to account for marketing as well, it's already broken even. which is really good to see, because I would like to see more directors take on passion projects like this and be rewarded for it, rather than somebody like Robert Eggers get sucked into the studio system where they would get him to churn out crap for a few years and then decide, because the crap that they've hired him as on as a director for, as Gun for Hire, didn't make them the money back, then all of a sudden his career is ruined. I'm glad he's not taking that road.
Yeah, because many talented directors have fallen prey to that, and also actors have gone into those films for the promise of a paycheck and they've struggled to get away from it. I think a good example of someone who's lived in the shadow of just accepting bad films is Nicolas Cage, and people say he's a bad actor, but it's not his acting. He elevates the bad films he's in. It's not that he's dragging it down, quite to the contrary. It's just that I think he got into a lot of debt and had to just accept lots of films and churn them out.
I believe it was the IRS wanted a lot of... Because Nicolas Cage was not the most diligent in paying his government taxes.
Just another reason to like the guy.
As a result, it ended up with him having to star in a lot of bad films so he could pay them back.
Well, now he lives in the UK, doesn't he? Yeah. He's got a house in Bath.
Also, he just loves starring in films. I think he's just mental and loves starring in films, which, you know, more respect to him. But on the subject of the budget, right, to show how overinflated the typical Hollywood budget is these days, I think a comparison is order. So a recent film that came out was called The Red One, I believe was what it was called.
Never even heard of it.
It was starring The Rock, and it was about Santa Claus being kidnapped, and The Rock teams up with Chris Pratt, one of the other ones from the Avengers, and ends up having to try and save Santa Claus from Krampus or whoever it is, right? That film had a $250 million budget, and $50 million of that alone was to pay for The Rock. So The Rock's entire paycheck for starring in that film was the same as the budget for this.
Mm-hmm. And
the film made no money back, mm-hmm. obviously, because it turns out paying $50 million to The Rock doesn't automatically guarantee your film will be a success, because most of the films The Rock stars in are shit.
Well, he's like a litmus test for will I watch that film. There are lots of actors like that where if they're in the film, I won't watch it.
And it's
also, Willem Dafoe is in this one. He's a much better actor than The Rock. It's not even... Yeah. It feels insulting comparing them. And I don't think he would... In fact, I think Willem Dafoe actually approached Eggers and said, I want to work with you, rather than the other way around.
Well, it's an excellent working relationship thus far, because the first collaboration they had was The Lighthouse. Mm-hmm. And since then, he's been in The Northman and now Nosferatu. The only film he's not been in was The Witch.
Let's talk about these films then. So Eggers' sort of filmography is The Witch was released in 2015, The Lighthouse in 2019, and The Northman in 2022. And I think it's worth just talking briefly about those films, because I think my favourite out of all of Eggers' films is The Lighthouse.
I'd have to agree with you there. Mm-hmm. The Lighthouse, for what it's aiming for, is perfect, mm-hmm. in every detail of that film. You can tell that it's the work of a genius artsy mind. It's not the sort of film that appeals to many people. I've shown it to friends. I got my family to watch it. They all came out of the other end of it disgusted and horrified that I got them to sit through it. But I think it's a masterpiece.
So do I, yeah. I think everything about it was done well. The fact that he used film that was authentic to the time he was trying to set it in, the aspect ratio, he got the dialogue was actually taken from old lighthouse keepers' journals and things like that, and he'd read lots and lots of period appropriate things to make sure there were no anachronistic things that stuck out. He also got two good actors in Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson, of course known for the Twilight films, but he's much more than that. He's actually a very solid actor.
He's an excellent actor when you get him with the right director in the right role. And The Lighthouse was a standout performance for him and for Willem Dafoe as well. And
both of them, yeah.
Yeah. And you can see why after you starred in something like that with that director, you'd go, all right, this guy's got a visionary eye. Mm-hmm. And I want to work with him more if it means I get to do more performances like this, more excellent character work like this. Because outside of anything else you can say about The Lighthouse, which is... it's a, for how claustrophobic and small scale it is, it's also very expansive in the interpretations and themes that you can glean from it. I've even seen some interpretations, which I would quite agree with, is that it's a stealth retelling of the myth of Prometheus.
I've seen that one, yeah, as well. Yeah.
Where Robert Pattinson is trying to steal fire, represented by the light at the top of the lighthouse, for the sake of expanding man's knowledge, and he's being guarded from it by Willem Dafoe, who's representing the rest of the pantheon, Poseidon in particular.
There are a few scenes that are explicit nods to Greek mythology as well.
And the last shot of the entire film where Pattinson's getting his guts eaten out by the crows. Mm-hmm.
Sorry if you wanted to watch the film.
Well, you know, I imagine there's still a lot more to the film.
That's true.
If you want to
Even if you know what happens, it's one of those films where if you watch it knowing what happens, you're still in for a wild ride and a good time.
Yeah. So, you know, I love The Lighthouse. After that, I'm trying to think of how I would rank his films. I'd probably put The Northman as my second favorite of his, because again, with his eye for period detail and his respect for history, I would say that Robert Eggers is the only reactionary filmmaker in Hollywood, and he's gone in interviews to basically say it as politely as possible. You'll notice a lot of his films have no diversity in them whatsoever, and he seems to choose period pieces that he would be able to say, well, I'm respecting the history and the perspectives of the people at the time. The Northman is a great example of that. It is brutal. It is uncompromising. The main character, Amleth, because it's retelling the story of Amleth, which was an old saga that was later adapted by Shakespeare into Hamlet. It takes these characters who are completely unpalatable to a modern mindset or modern Christian morality and shows them on their own terms.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't necessarily dress up. A lot of portrayals of Vikings are normally trying to make you sympathize with people and take sides. I'm thinking of a lot of the TV series that have been inundating.
Like Vikings. Like,
yeah.
I've never watched it.
Or what's it called? The one with Uhtred Ragnarsson, that one. The last
is that not Kingdom? Oh, I've not watched.
Anyway, all of those, I think they don't have enough respect for the history of it. Whereas one of the first scenes is when they carry out a raid on a Russian village, and it portrays the Vikings for what they actually did, the raiding, and it's awful. It's a truly awful thing. Mm. And at one point, you know, the character we're following, murdering men like it's nothing, and at one point he even hits a man off his horse with an axe, and then while he's on the ground bites his throat out and howls like a wolf. And this is the guy you're meant to sympathize with for the rest of the film.
Yeah, and also it shows that his fellow raiders herding a load of the women and children and the weak men into a hut and then burning it down. So it's uncompromising in its portrayal of what those raids would have looked like. And then, of course, those who survive, they take on a load of the women as slaves to be sold off.
But what Eggers does here by visualizing these things that did happen in history is it gives you a means of thinking about them in a much more human way. It's not just an abstraction that, oh, this thing happened. Like, one of the things that I rewatched that raid scene recently, just to sort of prepare for this. And one thing that struck me is that, well, if you're struggling to survive, you're not necessarily thinking about morality. You're thinking about how are these things useful to me? And so there's a sort of twisted logic to everything the Vikings do, because all of it is sort of optimizing what is best for me. And it's an entirely different way of looking at things. It's not, they're not thinking about morality, although, you know, by their own morality, it is moral, right?
Mm. Well, it's the fact that it can show you scenes like that, and by the end of the film, still have you rooting for Amleth and sympathizing with what he's going through, is the sign of a very, very impressive filmmaker who really knows how to tell these stories. Although, the Witch, what did you think of The Witch?
I think The Witch was actually one of my favourites. I really liked the whole approach to the film, the theme, the pacing of it. I liked the almost mythological approach to portraying a witch, where you don't really see her that much.
You see her very early on in the film.
You do see her early on in the film, but she doesn't take up much of the, you know, much of the runtime, should I say. And also, she sort of changes form a little bit. And it's sort of, even though they sort of give you the money shot and you see the witch early on, you kind of don't feel like it's been spoiled. Because also, she's... you see this horrible old woman, then you see this young woman, and it's because of the magic she's used.
Well, if nothing else, the witch is interesting because it does something that Eggers likes to do. I've seen even from this film, which is as early as possible let you know that there are dark forces operating in the world, and any sort of rationalistic explanations that the characters are giving, because in The Witch, obviously, the rationalistic explanation could be that, oh, well, they're all hallucinating because of the fact that they've got mold on their crops. Mm-hmm. No, that's not what's happening. There is a witch playing with forces behind the scenes, and everything that they're trying to do to prevent the inevitable from happening is futile, which, if anything, makes the film just that little bit more horrific. He doesn't play with suspense in the way that you expect some filmmakers to do. The suspense is the more Hitchcockian, which is that you know that something is... You, the audience, know what's wrong. Mm-hmm. The characters don't yet. Mm. So you are subject to more knowledge than they are, which can add to the suspense.
Yeah, I do agree.
I think the Witch was a really interesting debut for him. He kind of exploded onto the scene with that, and it set up his love for the period-accurate dialogue. Because really, I'd say it's that and... The Lighthouse, which has the most period accurate dialogue in it. And I say The Witch is the most impressive because it's going back to the late 17th century. And it took me a few watches to really get to grips with what the characters were even saying, and to be able to get child actors, multiple child actors, to convincingly give performances while delivering that dialect is insane.
I also thought the attention to detail in that they all have a sort of northern, almost Mancunian accent, don't they, when they're talking, but a sort of archaic one. And that attention to detail where, you know, only a handful of English people watching would be like, oh, that sounds really authentic.
Clickety-clackety.
Mercy.
Clickety-clackety. Clickety-clackety.
Quiet, and now just to rotten. I be a-washing father's clothes like a slave, and thou art playing idle.
Because mother hates you.
Spoilt child. Tell mother you have left the farm alone.
Black Philip saith I can do what I like.
Devil take your Black Philip.
Sure foot I can't leave the yard. I could go to the brook before you let the witch take Sam.
But if I had to rank the films, I'd probably put Lighthouse number one, probably Nosferatu second, purely for the visual aspect of it. I'll get into why I think there are things that prevent it from being top. Then The Witch, and then finally The Northman.
You'd put The Northman last.
Mm-hmm.
It's that lack of Germanic admixture in you, clearly. It sets you off. All you see is the Viking raiders assaulting your ancestors, where I see my ancestors assaulting your ancestors.
I don't know what it was. I think it was more the plot than anything else. I would have thought that a film about Vikings directed by Robert Eggers would be by far my favourite because it would appeal to me the most. However, I felt throughout the whole film that things weren't resolving in a way that I found satisfying. That doesn't mean, you know, that they didn't hold hands and it was happily ever after. It means that I just wasn't as emotionally satisfied by what happened in the film. As lots of other things.
I had a different experience, whereas I found the end of it very, very satisfying because Amleth is going out on his own terms. He's sticking to his own code of honour while also ensuring the safety of his descendants, where Anya Taylor-Joy is going off because she's pregnant with his children, and he gets to see a little bit of a glimpse of the future where his children will be rulers going on, and him being carried off by the Valkyrie. At the end, I found all of that very satisfying. I can understand if it didn't hit you emotionally, but Maybe it's just because it was so heavy metal. There was a kind of fist-pumping awesomeness to it. Action, really appealed to me.
I don't want people to think that I didn't like The Northman. The action scenes in it are my favourite out of all of Eggers' sort of more involved things.
Yeah, like, it's got... I mean, the raid scene alone has some awesome shots in it, even if it is brutal. So I would rank them. I'd go Lighthouse number one as well. Mm-hmm. Number two, I'd go The Northman. Number three, I'd go Nosferatu. And then number four, I'd go The Witch. Mm-hmm. I really respect The Witch as a tense, period-accurate experience. It just does not have... Maybe it's because of the strange dialect that they're using. The characters' dynamics don't have the same emotional impact to me as the other films that he's made. It's still an excellent film, still like an 8.5 out of 10 for me. Mm-hmm. And that's my least favorite of his. But I prefer the other ones that he's done since then.
Because I had no problem understanding the dialogue, because I basically grew up reading old literature. Like, the 19th century is basically modern to me by the time I was a teenager.
Where have you put your fedora, Josh? I'm sure you need to tip it somewhere, don't you?
It's not a fedora tipping moment. It's credit to my parents. I didn't do this. It was just that they were trying to introduce me to some higher culture.
Some classics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's one of those ones that is inaccessible, and I've watched it with people who speak English as a second language, and they really struggled. They had to have subtitles on.
It also sets up one of my new favorite Robert Eggers character trope, which is that in every film of his, except for The Lighthouse, because there are no children in it, there is a brutal murdering child scenes. Children die brutally in all of his films.
There are three things you need to know about Robert Eggers. His films will include almost autistically researched portrayals of history, child murder, and tits.
And you ask us why he's our favourite. Also, basically, no diversity.
No, that's true, yeah.
Whatsoever. I believe in Nosferatu, there is one diverse man who shows up for a grand total of two shots, lasting in total about 15 seconds, mm-hmm. which I found weird, but did not take me out of the film at all. And outside of that, the most diversity is there's a bunch of filthy gypsies in it, which is accurate to the original story as well. Mm-hmm. Although, to be fair, they're actually correct in what they're doing in the film.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.